people like to hear that I'm not alone. I wasn't the only one that got hacked or fooled. You have to have everybody reset their expectations that default humanity trust. I've talked to doctors, lawyers, dentists, CMOs, CISOs, a Nobel Prize winner in quantum physics, which is a pretty tough subject to understand. He got scammed out of $2 million.
Roger Grimes, a data-driven defense evangelist at KnowBefore, has been in computer security for over 30 years. You've heard us mention in previous episodes the value and reputation of KnowBefore. Roger Grimes is a good example. In this episode, he'll share some of his favorite stories and ways that you can protect yourself in the risk-ridden world of cybersecurity. This is the Cybercrime Lab, a podcast about true cybercrime stories, the impact on victims, and what businesses can do to protect themselves and their customers. And if you think you're not at risk, that is exactly where attackers want you to be.
In my experience, it only takes hearing what these attacks are like a few times to realize you need to prepare yourself for what could be a business-ending experience.
That's Andy Anderson, the founder and CEO of DataStream Insurance. For over a decade, Andy has been working with victims of cybercrime. He's seen firsthand the human impact of a cyber attack. Now, he's on a mission to shed light on the threats we all face from a world we can't see. Today, Andy has invited Roger Grimes to the Cybercrime Lab. For over 30 years, Roger has worked in this industry, and in the process has written 13 books, 1,200 magazine articles, and has consulted with hundreds of companies. Today, he's going to share some of his favorite stories with Andy and ways that you can protect yourself in the risk-ridden world that is cybersecurity.
Roger, I'd love for our listeners, just if you took, 30 seconds to introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about your background.
So I've been doing computer security 34 years. I really got into computers just to do computer security, and I was fighting Apple viruses and then DOS virus. I was disassembling DOS viruses for John McAfee, probably in 1988, 89. I was a PC network technician, network manager, eventually became VP of IT, but the whole time I'm just literally fighting viruses and hackers. I ended up even being in Newsweek magazine in 1992 for fighting the Michelangelo virus. And I've been on, all kinds of magazines and NPR, all things considered. I've written 13 books, 1,200 magazine articles, and I've consulted with hundreds and hundreds of companies, either on security reviews or responses to attacks, a lot of APT, advanced persistent threat stuff. I do a lot of stuff these days, especially around multi-factor authentication and threat and host defense and that sort of stuff. So really is to say that I've earned all of these gray hairs. I became an expert, quote unquote expert, just because I've been doing it forever. But, and every day I learn something new.
The space is just fascinating, right? Because so many changes in so many different ways. Sadly, criminals are getting pretty creative on a daily basis, the way that they attack different folks. But I know we were talking a little bit before we kicked things off about some of the stories that you have heard from different individuals. Again, I think it's interesting, I guess, because you're so public in this space, people actually send you these stories and get you involved. What's that like? Why do you think they tell you, or what's driving them reaching out to you?
Usually they're reading a story or two that I've written, and they're like, oh, I had that happen to me, or it's happening. A couple of years ago, I wrote a couple of stories on romance scams. And for years, I became really kind of an expert in trying to help people get relatives out of romance scams. The average person that would email me would have lost $100,000, $200,000, $500,000. And they're like, in my mother or my sister or my brother or whatever, I can't get them out of the scam. They're continuing to lose money. And so I would investigate, I would try to help. And what I found with romance scams, I became really good at proving to people, the person you're talking to, that's not their name, that's not their picture. And what I learned is it in no case ever changed them from wanting not to send more money. The heart has a mind, which the mind knows nothing of. But, that's, I kind of like it. It's kind of cool. I get to do computer security for a day job, and then I write, and that allows me to interact with more people and get more experiences that informs my day job plus writing as well. It's kind of nice. I'm glad I have both, right? Because I get to write about stuff. When you're writing, you learn about stuff, and then that brings people to me, and I learn. Oftentimes, things don't work the way that other people have written about them. And so it's kind of nice to to see how it really works. That like that hack is not nearly as easy as the hackers, or as USA Today said it was, you know, or it doesn't work quite the same or at all sometimes, you know. It's an interesting world.
One of the reasons that we started this podcast was to kind of bring to light, you know, some of the stories, the everyday sort of crimes that they're so common that they're almost not newsworthy. And so unfortunately then, you know, people, their perception is, you know, the news, right, of what the threat landscape is. And so they may not be hearing those stories. And so it's fun. It's also really sad to kind of hear these stories, but I think it really has value for folks to.
People like to hear that I'm not alone. I wasn't the only one that got hacked or fooled. And hopefully I try to always go, and this is how you defend yourself or whatever. Either a couple of days or a week ago, I wrote an article on LinkedIn about employment scams, about be careful. A lot of the jobs you may apply for could be fake and that sort of stuff. But also about employers that, hey, be careful. People that you might hire could be fake. And then I even talked about be careful. You could be offered a fake job because they're just trying to get to your employer. And somebody emailed me and we had discussions back and forth where this was the chief marketing officer for a mid-sized dental company. He told me they had a bunch of different locations in a particular region. And he was the first marketing person they had for this, you know, dental practice. But he'd been there and he'd been stymied that he didn't think he was being paid enough. So he got offered this dream job. He went through two job interviews. And at the end of it, they said, you've got the job, but we need to send you an employment application. They sent him a Word document and it had active content in it. And it said, you need to enable this active content to fill out the form.
Romance hacks have been around since the advent of the internet. But employment hacks are the new kids on the cyber attack block. It can be easy to get sucked into the idea of getting offered your dream job, but it's also important to stay on your toes in order to determine whether it's legit or not. One clue that may tip you off to a false job is if your potential employer asks you to fill out something like a Word document. This isn't typical and should serve as a red flag.
He filled out the form. I said, you know, stuff that asked him, normal stuff, but including his social security number and all this other stuff. So he said, that's now out there to them. But then the attackers, they'd used the malicious Word document to install malware on his system. They then collected all the passwords on his system. And of course, he had full admin rights across the network as a chief marketing officer. And then they went across the network and they ended up stealing money from the organization's bank account, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And this just happened the other day. So he said they're still trying to recover the information or recover the money. I'm not sure how it was stolen. But what surprised me is I'd read about a similar attack against a cryptocurrency company where somebody stole hundreds of millions of dollars. Well, I don't know how successful this dental company is, but they didn't steal hundreds of millions of dollars. It was probably tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars. So it's interesting that they're targeting smaller companies. He went through the two job interviews and he said that there was once or twice where he was a little bit concerned, but they had really good answers and they allayed his concerns. And, you know, so he, you know, and he ended up becoming, he's a person that follows and reads my columns and stuff like that. And he still became a victim. So, you know, it's unfortunate, but I was even saying, well, how do you stop that type of attack, right? Well, you have to say never run active content from any employer, I guess, before you're employed and working for them, before you get your first paycheck or something. That's a really long-term scam, right? I would think that it's going to fool most people.
It's a really interesting one, right? You know, and it plays upon a couple of the emotions and the sort of interesting things that an employee is, they're not probably revealing to their company that they're applying somewhere else. There's this sort of level of, you know, the employee being not duplicitous, but at least keeping things sort of under wraps for obvious reasons, but then utilizing that and glamming onto it to then using the emotional attraction of a new job to kind of like lure them in. And then that they're willing to go to that level of trust where they'll do two interviews. Like these aren't like, hey, I clicked on an email that's crappy and did this already. You've sort of established things, right? So yeah, that's next level, right?
Yeah, there was even a similar attack where this guy emailed me where he got a fake job interview, two interviews, and they were just getting an iPhone. They told him that in order to get logged onto the company network, he had to have an iPhone that had a special MFA in it. And they made him, on his credit card, order an iPhone and ship it to the company location where they would install the MFA software and then ship it to him. And then he found out as soon as the iPhone was shipped to that location, he never heard from them again. You're like, wow, he had multiple job interviews for something that was $1,000. But these are probably call centers, probably in Asia, somewhere over there, maybe Cambodia or something, where they're just doing 100 of these a day. You've got an 8-hour shift. How many of these $1,000 scams can you pull off in, you know, your 8 or 10-hour shift? They're probably making money.
Yeah. I mean, again, the ROI is pretty high in a bunch of these things. And just playing on the emotions, it's a theme we keep hitting on. It's the criminals are willing to do low dollar amount. I mean, the iPhone's sort of truly petty crime almost. But they'll make money off it. So they're willing to do it. And as you think through these events, what would you have kind of the listeners or folks do? I mean, how do you, I mean, we've alluded to this. That's really hard to stop. Is there anything you would recommend or think through if knowing what they know now?
Maybe it's us, you know, being exposed to so much scams and frauds and stuff, but you have to have everybody reset their expectations that default humanity trust. You know, we have this default trust, and I'm pulling this from a Bruce Schneier book. You know, we order a pizza and then we open our door to some stranger at the front that has a pizza uniform on or not, and we get our pizza. And that's society functions because of trust. Like, when a police officer stops us, sometimes it could be a fake police officer. We arrest those people all the time that have a fake badge and a fake, you know, blue lights on their car. But society mostly functions on this default level of, okay, what I'm seeing is probably real. But especially in the online world, you really have to get this culture. You have to change your mind and really for your organization, change the culture of default trust to I'm going to have default skepticism. Because you can't trust somebody that calls you. You can't trust an SMS message. You cannot trust an email. And, you know, or like another person said, oh, I got, you know, they're on Indeed.com trying to get a job. And they got sent an email that said, oh, you know, we like you for one of our positions and had an alternate email address. So they're trying to get them off the Indeed platform. So I think we have to share stories and scenarios. I've talked to doctors, lawyers, dentists, CMOs, CISOs, a Nobel Prize winner in quantum physics, which is a pretty tough subject to understand. You got to be smart to get a Nobel Prize in quantum physics. He got scammed out of $2 million.
As easy as it can be to want to believe everyone you see and trust everyone you meet, the world unfortunately doesn't work this way. Now, we're not here to tell you that suspicion and paranoia of everyone is healthy. Rather, we want to encourage you to take Roger's advice and become a bit of a skeptic, especially when you're online.
Trying to stop these scams and not be scammed is not a thing of intelligence. It's, are you aware of these sort of scams? And you have to share stories with people so that they understand some of the common traits. And this is what I say, the common traits most of the time are you get an unexpected communication. And the channel can vary. It can be email. It can be instant messaging. It can be social media. It can be a phone call. It can be whatever. But you get this unexpected communication. They're reaching out to you. The person is, even if they're somebody that you know or pretending to be, you know, a brand you respect, they're asking you to do something you've never done before. You know, open up this Word document and fill out the security application. That's kind of weird. Right? You're thinking, I've never done that before. No one's ever sent me a Word document and then told me to open it and fill out the security thing. And then they're usually a stressor event. You need to do this now to get the job. You need to do this now to get to not miss the discount. You need to do this now. We're going to lose the deal or something. And if performing the requested action, if it's malicious, could harm your interest or your organization's interest, well, so let me say it again. Message arrives unexpectedly. It's asking you to do something for the first time. It has a what we call a stressor event. There's something stressing you that you need to do it now to get something, the job or whatever. And if it could be malicious, if those four traits are true, you need to slow down what you're doing and verify using some other means. Like for the fake job scam, you would contact the real employer. If they're pretending to be Microsoft or whoever, you'd call them and go, does HR actually have this position advertised? You could go to Microsoft's website.
We think it's important to take a moment and reiterate what Roger just mentioned. If you've got a pen and paper, this would be a good time to write this down. There are four traits of a common scam. 1, unexpected communication. 2, the first time this person or brand has asked you to do something like what they're asking. 3, there's a strange sense of urgency. 4, there's a clear potential for this actor to be malicious. Got it? Good.
That'd be hard to do. I mean, again, like, that's why it's so good. I mean, let's say you actually got a job offer from Microsoft. Who are you going to call at Microsoft? I mean, Microsoft in particular, like, good luck getting anybody on the phone ever, right? You know, for all things, right? So you picked a particularly sore spot.
I worked there for 11 years.
You understand the phone trees.
I always laugh about the scam that is, we're from Microsoft and we're proactively calling you to tell you we have a virus and we want to help. I'm like, I love Microsoft. I worked there for 11 years, but if you could find the right phone number to call and you had $500 to give Microsoft, you're probably still not going to get help. Like, that's the reality. That's why you got to share the story. That's why they call it security awareness training. You have to share the story so that people know that if you've heard Microsoft never calls you, well, you're less likely to be scammed. Let's say Craigslist. I don't know about you. First time, have you ever advertised on Craigslist?
Yeah,
the first time I did, because you hear all your friends, oh, I'm getting rich. Oh my God, I can't believe how fast I sold that bench press that I've had in my garage for 20 years. But the first time I advertised on Craigslist, immediately scams started coming. Like, yes, I'll gladly pay full price and shipping and just use my escrow agent or I'll send you a check. So I have to assume a lot of Craigslist people just don't know that they're scams, and you need to know that they're not going to pay full price plus shipping. And it's kind of weird that they're going to send you a check. They're going to send you this check and then they want you to remit some of it to their shipper or something like that. But now I tell people, if you go on Craigslist, it's got a lot of scammers, and many times the first person that responds to you will be a scam artist. So be careful. I even have a friend, he used to make up non-existent things. He'd like sell a thingamajig, a truck jack stand. He would just make up items to put on Craigslist to scam the scammers. And then his hobby was getting them to spend money. You know, he goes, I got your check, but then your check, I accidentally spilled water on it. Can you send me another check? So they'd have to use Fed Express to resend another check. And his thing was to scam them back and get them to waste as much of their time and money. But he would just make non-existent stuff like, oh, we'll take that. The truck stand jack, we'll pay full price and pay shipping for this non-existent thing.
I've been called by hackers or criminals who are attempting to, you know, scam me, and I know too much. And so, like, yeah, I keep them going for a while and, like, ask them some questions and then, like, oh, can we do this? Like, oh, can we take some time? Like, tell me more. Again, eventually, like, they figure that, you know, the jig is up and you're wasting their time.
I try to get to them emotionally. I was like, listen, would your mother and father be proud that you're scamming people? What? Like this, I was like, in your religion, does the leader of your religion, do you think your God or gods are going to be happy that you're going out of your way to hurt people? I literally am emotionally trying not to just do a dig, but trying to get them to question why they're doing this unethical, illegal line of work that they've decided is fine to do. So I don't know if I reach any of them, but I'm trying.
One of the things that is interesting is to sort of think about the emotional pieces. We've talked about this. We had a particular episode that, you know, really got into some of the emotional challenges that these attacks create. And I think you alluded to it at the beginning of this call. One of the benefits of hearing about them is to understand that you're not alone. And also that culpability isn't, that you as the victim shouldn't be, I'm not going to say that you're entirely faultless, right? Because you may have made mistakes or done things that weren't sort of best practices, but we don't shame the victims of things in other areas the way we do, almost to the level of sport in this community sometimes, right? Like every single time an attack happens, you see in social media the sort of like, let's highlight the stupidity of this organization and the one little thing that they missed, when most of us live in glass houses. And what isn't newsworthy is the 10,000 things that that organization and that security team have to do.
I have a saying, like when someone says, oh, this bank got broken into, I'm like, that's the bank that they're writing about today. There's 10,000 other banks that are currently broken into. I live in Tampa, Florida, and down the street from me is a power company. It was in the news because a hacker broke into the power company and then changed and made the chemicals like a million times more deadly or something like that. And I'm like, listen, that's every power company in the world. It's not just this one down. And literally, they actually publicly went out of their way without being asked, talked about it. Let's learn from it. Let's not say they're evil. Yeah, every time I hear someone, you're right, throw the rock from the glass house, I'm like, and let me say, when I worked at Microsoft, there would be times like Google would be caught with something, or the Google browser had had something in it. And boy, we were suspiciously quiet. Like a lot of times, a lot of people are like, whoo, now we have time to fix and address this issue without making the news because somebody else took the bullet for us. But yeah, and you're right. And just people in general, like there's a friend of mine at Microsoft Research. His name escapes me right now. Maybe I have post-COVID brain fog. I got COVID from RSA. But he said, you can model how you think a billion people are going to react, but a billion people are going to react the way that a billion people are going to react, and you might have to change your model. And, you know, like, let's say with self-driving cars, with Tesla and all, you have these self-driving cars, and they're telling people, you must pay attention. While this car is self-driving, you must pay attention. But we know that people are running into fire trucks, 18-wheelers, hitting people walking across the street because they are not paying attention.
While we love the idea of having a self-driving car, Roger makes an excellent point. In the same way that some Tesla drivers don't pay attention when they should be, some companies, big or small, aren't paying attention to their cybersecurity when they should be.
So whose fault is that? We're trying to get EV software that is supposedly more accurate driving than the average human, but you're telling people to pay attention when they've got thousands of miles where they don't really need to pay attention, but then you want them to pay attention during this high risk event. It's just interesting again about you can make a system and say something, but we're human and humans are going to fade off. And you go down the highway and see somebody reading a book while they're in their Tesla, and you're like, that person's certainly not paying attention. But that's humans, and you can't take the humans out of humanity, and we have to redesign our software and our systems to figure out the flaws in a human, or just the humanness of the human. Maybe it's not a flaw. It's just the way we're engineered. We're wet masses of things and emotional, and we have to make sure our systems account for that.
That human-machine interface and how the two kind of work together is a really interesting space. And to realize that both sides are far from perfect. The error rate on humans is probably much higher than the machine. But also to understand the true complexity and the amount of things that these machines are doing. Like, you just look at like the number. We had a really interesting conversation with one of our other guests, and you know, you just started to understand the number of like security team members to like overall employees, and it was well over 100 to 1. You're expecting this one individual to like corral the actions and the processes of 100 people who are doing all different things. And obviously what's fun about training is you're starting to arm those people on the front end. The one thing I worry about from a training perspective is it's, even if we do better on a training perspective, we might drop the error rate from 30% to 5%, which is again, a massive improvement, but there's still 5%, right? Or maybe it's 2%. But when you look at the volume of attacks, thinking through like, what's the after? Things are still going to get through and creating multiple failure points along the system. So if one can fail, and then the results of that are not catastrophic or massive.
Overlapping defense in depth. Actually, what you brought up about the human stuff, like I was thinking about, we're all told you have to have a different password for every site and service. And they also tell people that they're not supposed to be a pattern. The average person is logging into over 170 different websites in a given year. The average person only has 3 to 7 passwords that they use across over 170 websites, of course. Because if the average person, without the help of a password manager or MFA, actually had a different login name and password for every website, they would be an idiot savant. We'd be having them on the late night talk show going, Roger, here's your website. Tell me what your password is. Anybody that can remember more than 7 passwords that are completely different and unique and don't have a pattern, you would be an idiot savant. So our old password policy was literally telling people, we want you to be the most incredible idiot savant that there's ever been in this world. And that's what everybody has to be.
It's reality, right? What I'm hoping for, you're just starting to see that the technology really appreciate the security threat more. And so in this transition period, the answer is like a password manager and multi-factor authentication on everything that you can, you know, using those means. But the next step is that you're trying to, as much as possible, take the human out of that loop, and you're using the proximity that you're geofencing folks, you're using IP addresses, you're using like the device IDs. And again, is that stuff perfect? No. Can it be faked? Sure. But the challenge to do that is such that, again, like you just massively reduce the error rate and the likelihood of that happening and making everybody else's life easier. So moving kind of to that passwordless future. And that's what I think the good security teams that I see and interact with are doing, as much as possible, make the easy path the most secure path. And again, make humans' life, hey, oh, actually, I don't need any passwords. If I'm sitting at my desk, I'm getting logged into everything because it knows I'm sitting here and it knows I've got, you know, my phone right next to me and, you know, and I'm using the same laptop and occasionally I have to put my finger on stuff or it takes a picture of my face.
We aren't living in a passwordless world just yet. It's important not to underestimate the power of multi-factor authentication and a strong cybersecurity team behind you. And as Roger will fill us in on shortly, you'll want to have a focus on an MFA that's phishing resistant.
The zero trust idea, which is we're going to look at you, and if you start to do something that's out of character or suspicious, then we'll ask for higher levels of assurance, you know, kind of like your credit card. You use your credit card all the time and, you know, maybe they ask for a signature, but you're doing everything. You can buy hundreds of dollars of stuff. I remember one day, though, I was in a Walmart buying two TVs. I just moved in a house and I wanted to get some TVs. My wife was buying a TV. I was buying a TV and we were in separate registers because the TVs were so big. And then the credit card company turned it down, right? Because, hey, how is Roger or his family buying two large screen TVs at a Walmart, which he never does? And that's an appropriate time to go, hey, is this really you? Call us to confirm this transaction. But otherwise, they are not bugging me. If I had bought just one TV in the Walmart, they probably wouldn't have bothered me, you know, or maybe I travel to a new city or state or something, and then they'll do something. But at the same time, this is just shocking to most people. The credit card companies, when they're trying to improve the process or making sure they don't deny you with a fault, what they call false positive, because if they stop you, Andy, from buying something two or three times in a given year, you're probably going to use somebody else's credit card product. And so it's interesting. They actually think they have fraud to an acceptable level of business expense. When they get companies that are going to help them to determine good or bad, there's all these companies. There's a whole cottage industry of companies that help credit card companies figure out good and bad transactions. The vast majority of the resources are spent to make sure they don't accidentally deny a legitimate transaction, because that cost is more expensive than the cost of them sometimes letting a hacker through.
That, like others, is a mature area of risk analysis and risk prevention, right? And you're at that level where you've gotten control of the risk to the point where you actually are going to accept a certain amount of it. Because again, you're starting to balance the two costs, the potential loss from criminal activity versus the customer loss. And I think that's what we're going to start to see in more of IT, and why during my day job where I'm working in cyber insurance, you know, starting to bring real metrics and understanding around kind of the impacts of different technologies on losses and the impacts of different processes and policies. You instrument that so you can actually start to measure, okay, how much might this bring down the loss? You know, I think we're even just starting that process. And then I think that the future state is where you're balancing that. You'd hope that all the security improvements do what we talked with, like with passwordless, like that it's both more secure and a better user experience, but we know that's not the case for all things. Even different security technologies that we're seeing, it's blocking malicious websites. You know, I've been accounting that with a security tool that we use, but it's actually blocking a lot of legitimate websites. It's quite annoying, particularly if it's, you know, happening in real time or when there's not a process to say, you know, to know this is legitimate. I've checked all of these things to think through that. So
insurance companies are getting more involved in cybersecurity. And I realize that finally the adults that know how to do actuarial tables are into this mess, you know, because we need them, because we're not focusing on the right things. Yet the cybersecurity industry, cyber insurance industry is really interesting, making some of the mistakes that have been made in cybersecurity. Like the big thing in cybersecurity, you got to have MFA, And they're like, it's the make or break. You're going to have a hard time getting cyber insurance if you don't have multi-factor authentication. it really is not as protective as most people think. And it really shouldn't be this binary decision. And really, we need to be pushing what's called phishing-resistant MFA. 90-95% of MFA is as easily phishable as your password, which means why go to it? Why go to all the expense and move everybody to MFA if I can just get around it as easy as I could your password? So like the cyber insurance industry, I want to tell them, make sure you're telling them to use phishing-resistant MFA. That's a big deal.
I'm curious. I'm not familiar with that. I mean, what would you consider phishing resist? What falls into sort of phishing resistant MFA?
So I write about this a lot. The U.S. government has said not to use easily phishable MFA, which they define as anything tied to your phone number. So voice calling MFA, SMS based MFA. They also say don't use one-time password MFA, which is the majority of it out there, and push-based MFA. So it basically describes 90-95% of the MFA that people use. I write about this a lot in LinkedIn. I've written about it in books and articles. I write about it every week.
So what's non-phishable MFA?
Something that's FIDO-enabled would be a big class. There's a lot of MFA that's not phishable. It's just that most people aren't using them. Anything FIDO-enabled is less phishable. Everything's hackable. Everything's phishable, but it's not binary. It's a continuum from, you know, white to black and a lot of gray in between. You'll see a lot of FIDO stuff that's less phishable. Smart cards, what's called NIST. You'd have to listen to the recording to get this again, but NIST 800-63-3. That's a standard that talks about digital identities. AAL assurance level 3. Anything that has that is not phishable. Military CAC cards, but there's lots of vendors like Beyond Identity. Their solution is not phishable. I have a list on the internet on LinkedIn called List of Strong MFA that I like, and it's the ones that aren't easily phishable.
We'll definitely share that. What I'd love to think through is like that the piece that we've been talking about is, you know, MFA is a move in the right direction. Asking people to have proximity cards, and particularly if they're not an employee, right? Like you don't have a relationship with the organization where they're an employee of yours. Like, how do you think about MFA when, for example, your email provider or some of these others where like Google doesn't have, like, is Google not going to have you ship a, I guess you can enable a couple of different ways for that. But when it's more of like a consumer type relationship and the number of users is massive, I'd love to think what the enrollment process into that MFA is really interesting, as well as the, like, you know, the actual login, right? Are we in a world of reality to touch on?
Not only that, but MFA, as much as you may love it, all has its cost, increased cost. Like today, I was on a mid-sized company to large company, a multi-billion dollar company's call today, and the CSO was having to tell the employees, after using a device like this for a year, he's like, make sure it's plugged in the right way. So it's an IT company, a large IT company, and he was having to tell them, make sure you have plugged in the USB key in the right direction, because we're getting a ton of calls for people for months now that are plugging it in upside down. He said, make sure you're plugging it in so that you can see the terminals. And this is an IT company with very sophisticated people. So those are the side effects of people, oh, I'll just implement MFA. It's not as easy as implementing MFA, right? There's cost and resources and support cost and, you know, all that. There's a lot of stuff to think about.
Our listeners are aware that we are big proponents of MFA. We talk about it on the podcast all the time, but it's important to know when to look beyond it and to make sure that you're doing as much as you can to defend your information from cyber threat actors. MFA is not the end-all be-all, and we'd all be wise to remember that.
In the interest of time, I think we got to wrap it up, but Roger, I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much for coming on. Any last thoughts before we close?
You ready for this? The three biggest things anybody can do to protect themselves and their company is try not to be socially engineered, whatever that means. Number two, make sure you patch all your software. Number three, use non-phishable MFA where you can. A password manager to create unique passwords where you can't. Those three or four hints I just gave you, if followed really well, would defeat 99% of all hacking. And there's nothing else you can think of that you would ever tell me. Firewall, VPN, antivirus, endpoint detection, response time. None of it is fight social engineering, patch your software, use non-phishable MFA and unique passwords. That is it. That is 99%. You do that, you will probably never be hacked.
Well, thank you, Roger.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Cyber Crime Lab, brought to you by Datastream Insurance. When the worst happens, you're going to want the best financial, legal, and technical support to get you back up and running again. With cyber insurance from DataStream, we find the most comprehensive insurance coverage on the market alongside critical post-incident customer support. Go to datastreaminsurance.com today and see how we can help you secure your business data. That's datastreaminsurance.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe and give us a 5-star review. You'll find show notes and any resources mentioned at cybercrimelabpodcast.com. We hope you'll join us next episode. Until then, stay safe. More importantly, stay ready.